This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today, we're talking about Scott County, Indiana, which made national headlines in 2015 after a drug-fueled HIV outbreak ravaged the rural community. When it happened, there was one physician in the city of Austin, and we're spending the hour with him to talk about his experience, what he learned, and his new book called Canary in the Coal Mine. With us now is Dr. William Cook. Thank you so much for joining us. He runs an HIV-HCV clinic in Scott County. Dr. Cook, I just want to ask, what brought you to Scott County to begin with?
Yeah, I'm from southern Indiana, so I grew up in the Basic area. When I went to medical school, I knew I wanted to go to a community that didn't have a doctor, that didn't have access to medical care. And so when I was graduating and finishing up my residency training, I started looking around Indiana and Appalachia and the Rust Belt. I wanted to stay fairly close to home, but I could literally, you know, throw a dart at the map and find a community in need. There was just need all over the place. And so, you know, being from New Albany and Austin being really about 40 minutes from New Albany, where my parents and my family were from, I found that community. And they didn't have a doctor since the 1970s. A lot of people had really grown up, had a generation of people grow up without access to medical care. So that was the community I found. I loved the people. They were very similar to my family coming out of Appalachia myself. And I just connected with the people in the community and opened my practice there in 2004.
And what kind of practice did you open?
Yeah, it's a family medicine practice. So when I was in residency, I made sure that I was trained to do just about anything that walked in the door, including C-sections, high-risk pregnancies. I spent time in the emergency department learning how to take care of emergency situations. Went overseas and spent some time in resource-poor countries trying to learn how to take care of communities that didn't have a lot of access to resources, so that I would feel prepared when I opened my practice for anything that walked in the door. But even with all of that, I was not prepared for the level of suffering that I saw when I opened my practice there.
Right. Well, before we get into all that, I'm just curious, that do you think more doctors need to have the types of experiences that you did going to other places that were lacking resources to be a better doctor?
I think it's important for physicians to really understand the basic elements of what it is to be a healthy human, a healthy person. And it really, you know, boils down to those Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where people need to feel safe. They need to have their basic human needs met. They need to have a sense of belonging and a sense of civic muscle, that their views matter and they can make change within their communities, and that they have meaningful work and safe places to gather. I think physicians really need to understand those, because, you know, we're trained throughout medical school to do no harm, but that to me seems very passive. It's, you know, I'm going to sit back in my clinic, wait for people to come to me and not harm them. I feel like we need to kind of evolve that into protect from harm. And most mm-hmm. of what harms people occurs outside of our clinics. It's out where people are born, they live, they play, they grow old and die. And unless we get out into the community, really understand what it is to be a healthy person, a prosperous person, a person with well-being, and understand what that community's needs are, then as physicians, we're not able to respond to those needs and help people really live an abundant life. And mm-hmm. There's a Bible verse that says that Christ came to bring life more abundantly to people. And that was my motto when I first opened my practice, is to try to figure out ways to help people live more abundantly.
Well, it's interesting you're mentioning some of the stuff. I was just reading an article that was kind of blasting medicine, saying it's more reactionary than preventative. It's like until you get to the doctor's office and find out you have all these things, there's nothing done to kind of like get you a healthy life.
Right. I'm hopeful with, you know, this last year's been really devastating, obviously, and we've all gone through a lot. But one of the silver linings in it is the use of telemedicine and remote patient monitoring, where medical providers can actually extend what they're doing into people's lives, where they work and play and where they grow in their homes. And so, you know, we're able to connect with people in their homes. And my nurse can stay more connected with them and pull up a video chat. And I'm hopeful that that allows us to get outside of the clinic and, like you said, be reactionary and be more proactive, trying to prevent things from occurring instead of waiting for them to occur.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you started in Scott County, you mentioned there hadn't been a doctor there since the 70s. What was it like for you when you came in and wanted to open the practice? Was there resistance, acceptance?
No, they really wanted a doctor in the community. The hospital helped recruit me into the community, the county commissioners, and the hospital that supported our local hospital, since it's a small critical access hospital. They all chipped in and really did their best to try to help offset overhead for my practice for about 18 months so that I didn't have to, you know, take out a whole lot of debt to be able to open the practice, even though I had to pay that back through loan forgivenesses. Mm-hmm. It was a very welcoming experience from that standpoint. On the other side, you know, people from Appalachia, they tend to be a little distrusting at first. So it took me a few years to break through that. They had a few doctors come in and try to establish a practice and then leave. And so it took a few years before people started coming in and saying, you know, I wasn't sure if you were going to stay or not. But mm-hmm. now that you've been here a few years, you know, I guess I can let you be my doctor now. So that was the first few years experience there.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine I've heard of programs where rural communities are trying to recruit doctors, but it seems like it's such a high turnover. Like they do their 2 years right. or whatever it is, and they're out of there. So it seems like you were able to settle down and really make it a community.
It's a hard thing to do, to open a private practice and be able to really, you know, see enough people, and doctors only get paid for seeing patients, and they only get paid when the insurance or the patients are able to pay them. Places like Austin, you know, it's a lot of uninsured people, a lot of people on Medicaid, Medicare, that traditionally, you know, pays much lower. And so once my 18 months were coming to an end, and I wasn't going to continue to have that hospital support to cover my overhead, I really wasn't at a place where I was able to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. What we were bringing in from patient visits wasn't really covering the meager overhead we had. And it's really just three exam rooms, a procedure room, and two staff members. We weren't really doing a lot from an overhead standpoint, but the revenue coming in really wasn't going to match that. And so I had to get a little creative and start doing some moonlighting in the emergency department to offset that shortage that we were going to experience. But yeah, most doctors, you know, they struggle in rural areas like this, unless they can find creative ways to make it work.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were the biggest needs that you saw when you first came into the community? Were there any sort of striking health disparities?
Yeah. So, you know, basic primary care and prevention needs were going unmet. So there were, you know, there were pregnant moms that were going without prenatal care. There were children growing up without immunizations. There were women who had never been screened for cervical cancer. And through screening, no one should ever experience late stage cervical cancer. Cervical mm-hmm. cancer used to be the leading cause of death among women. But with modern technology, through preventative care, screening, no one should ever die of cervical cancer. But those first few years, by doing routine PAPs and screening for cervical cancer, unfortunately, I had to diagnose several women with late stage cervical cancer and end up, you know, watching them suffer and die from a disease that they should have never died from. And it really struck me that here, you know, here I am in the wealthiest nation on earth with the most resources on earth. And yet there are people, you know, in Indiana, you know, suffering and dying, sometimes alone, from diseases that should have been prevented in the first place.
That's tough to have to witness. And do you think, I mean, was there a reason why this community was overlooked, for example, like for there not to be a doctor for so many years? I get that people are coming and leaving, but was there anything else that it was just like overlooked?
Well, again, it's hard to establish and maintain a practice in a rural area with high unemployment, low reimbursement, a lot of uninsured people. And there were, you know, like I said, there were doctors that came in and tried for a few years and then just wasn't able to maintain that. So it's a very difficult thing to do to maintain a practice in an area that has a pocket of concentrated poverty like Austin or even some urban areas. And what makes rural areas that much more vulnerable is the lack of transportation. There's not any public transit, you know, to get people, you know, from where they live to a hospital or to a medical center to be able to do the screening and the preventative care that they really need. I had people walk to my office to be seen by me by a healthcare provider for the first time in years or sometimes even their lives. I remember this one guy came in a few months after I opened. He walked to my clinic. He hadn't been able to get to a doctor otherwise. And he had a tumor on the side of his tongue so large, he couldn't close his mouth. He just had this handkerchief that he would hold up against his mouth to catch the drool coming out. Wow. You know, it's very disfiguring, you know, very humiliating. You know, how he was able to eat and all of that was beyond me. And just the idea that somebody would allow something to go that long without, you know, being seen really, you know, struck me. And, you know, still bothers me to this day that somebody could be living in America that way, but he couldn't get to a doctor because he didn't have a car. Mm-hmm. He didn't have mm-hmm. a car. His family didn't have a car. They just kind of, you know, walked everywhere that they needed to go. And so since I opened my practice, he was able to walk down, see me. Then we were able to get him emergency Medicaid, get him a doctor, you know, that would see him for this need. Medicaid provides transportation. So we were then able to get him to the specialist. But without having access to all of that, no matter how hard he tried, he would never be able to get that need met.
Right, right. So, well, we'll continue our conversation after this quick break. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about the opioid epidemic, specifically the unprecedented HIV and hepatitis C outbreak that happened in Scott County, Indiana, in 2015. Before the break, we were talking about the lack of healthcare resources in rural areas such as Austin. If you have any questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. With us again is Dr. William Cook, who runs a primary care clinic in Scott County. Dr. Cook, before we get more into the details about the outbreak, I'm just curious, like, did you ever consider leaving to go somewhere else when you were presented with all of these things that you had seen? Did it frustrate you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. After it was about 6 years into being there, I didn't feel like I was really making the difference that I thought I would by going there. I had this idealistic idea that, you know, by surrendering to God and going and serving God in an area like this, that, you know, he would use me to make a difference, to change things. And from 2004 to 2008, we really struggled to meet those needs. And it was hard to keep the doors open and continue to see a lot of suffering, a lot of, you know, people not thriving in life. And then the Great Recession hit, and we went from, you know, really bad to terrible. And I really questioned, you know, why was I doing this? Why was I, you know, surrendering so much and sacrificing so much and not really making a difference and actually seeing things get worse? And mm-hmm. and so I decided that I was going to really think about leaving Austin. And so I joined a mission trip and went to the Amazon rainforest in the middle of nowhere to get away from everything and really, you know, soul search and you know, be alone with God.
Mm-hmm. And so did that offer you sort of a different perspective to get away from the community for a little bit?
It did. I remember going into these villages and just seeing how the villages we're really, you know, about community, about helping each other and, you know, giving up part of who they were to help their neighbors. I remember playing soccer, you know, with an entire village, you know, men, women, children, all just kind of running around, and they didn't divide up teams. It's a really kind of interesting thing. They just kind of organically decided, you know, this team was over here and this team was over here, and people would come in and out. And it felt like that everybody was part of one big thing. And then I remember, you know, floating down the Amazon on the back of this boat. Actually, it was before we got to the Amazon. It was through these two rivers that come together at a place called the Meeting of the Waters. And one's really kind of dark, minerally water, and one's really a light brown, muddy water. And they come together, and you can see the demarcation really clearly. And then they slowly merge into one river. And that river is the greatest river on earth. It's the Amazon River. But those two rivers have to give up who they are to become the Amazon. So, you know, I was experiencing all of this and really thinking about Austin and my role there. And I remember sitting out on the back of the boat one night, and it was just pitch black. No, you know, no city lights. We're in the middle of the Amazon. It's just pitch black, and all the stars were out. These shooting stars started streaking across the sky. And I tried to pray, but I didn't have anything to say to God. It was completely empty at that point. I didn't know what else to do. And so instead of praying words, I just kind of listened. And I really felt like God was telling me that, you know, it wasn't about me. I had made it about me, but it wasn't about me. It's about the people in Austin, and I'm just a part of that. And so I realized then that the story of Austin was the story of Austin, and I needed to surrender my part in that to become part of Austin's story, and go back and not try to be some hero. Austin didn't need a hero. There wasn't going to be some outside force that was going to come in and fix Austin. It was going to be this organic thing that grew up from the people in Austin. And I was just going to be a part of that. I would try to love people, care for people, listen, and try to learn about the needs that people were experiencing, and then try to figure out ways to bring resources there to meet those needs. And so I went back with a different mentality and a different view, and just figured, you know, I would spend my career there. And at the end of my career, I'd pass that on to whoever, you know, came after me. And hopefully Austin was a little bit better by the time I hung things up.
Mm-hmm. Well, then it seems like years later into your journey there, after you decided to come back full force. I mean, I know you were there, but you had your sort of revelation epiphany in the Amazon. What was the opioid situation like when you were there in the years leading up to the HIV outbreak? Did you foresee that this was going to escalate?
Yeah, it was escalating. And the HIV hepatitis C outbreak was really just an evolution of what was already occurring. When I opened my practice in 2004, the community was overrun with OxyContin, Percocet, Xanax, Soma. It was rampant there. It was one of those pockets of concentrated toxic stress and you know, high unemployment, you know, people really suffering. And in order to deal with all that suffering and toxic stress and all, they were turning to substances. They were finding that these prescription painkillers, they don't just relieve pain that's physical. It also relieves pain that's emotional. And so I saw a lot of people addicted and just struggled year after year how to try to, you know, figure out ways to help people. I took people on, tried to wean them off, but that still left them with this life that was filled with suffering. And more times than not, they turned back to it. So I realized it was more than just, you know, the drugs. It was an underlying toxic environment that was causing that. And then the Great Recession just made that so much worse. And then going into 2010-11, that's when the prescription Opana, the formulation was changed, and the effort was to make it harder to abuse by changing how the pill was structured so that it couldn't be crushed and snorted. But what people found, because they were still dependent on it, they would go through horrible withdrawal if they didn't have it. And we're talking, 10 days of the worst flu you can imagine. Body aches, restlessness, insomnia, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. We think it's bad when we go through two days, we can't go to work, call in. Imagine 10 days, of nonstop restlessness, insomnia, all of that. People that were trying to stop using often found it too difficult to overcome those physical symptoms that they were experiencing. And then they still had that toxic environment, that life that was causing so much chaos and pain, still waiting for them. And so the drive to figure out a way to use was intense. And so people found that they could melt down the Opana, and then inject it.
Mm. So they found sort of these workarounds, but where were they able to get these medications? I'm just wondering, because I guess when I'm thinking of a rural area with lack of access to things, I'm like, well, how are you getting all of this other stuff?
I had the exact same question. I did. And it boggled my mind that here's a place without access to medical care, preventative care. I'm watching these people suffer and die from a lack of medical care, yet they seem to have so much access to prescription drugs. And, we're right off of 65, I-65 that runs from, Alabama up to Chicago. And there were these clinics, set up all along there, willing to prescribe large quantities of painkillers. We've looked into this in Scott County to try to figure it out. And Scott County leads the state for patients using prescription drugs. But the doctors within Scott County, it's like a fraction compared to the average doctor in the state of Indiana. So the doctors inside of Scott County were not the ones prescribing these large quantities of opioids. It was doctors outside of Scott County. And people would go get these prescriptions, bring them back, and then oftentimes sell them. It became a form of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a job, but you can get, a bunch of OxyContin or Opana, and come back, and you can trade Opana for a place to stay or for some food or for some diapers for your kid. So it became a currency, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about the HIV outbreak and the response to it as something that was an extremely quick thing. Things changed overnight. What was that time like for you?
It was overwhelming, honestly. Here I was asking for help for years. I saw this getting worse and worse. And even though, I knew that I could provide some care, I knew that I wasn't the answer. I knew that there needed to be a lot more services available to people. So I would go to hospitals, I'd go to churches, I would go to community health centers, I would go to behavioral health, try to get psychiatrists and addiction specialists and AA programs and all of that to come to Austin. But year after year, I was told that, people didn't have enough resources to expend into Austin. I reached out to the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services to figure out if there was a way that they could help provide addiction services. And their medical director was kind enough to offer her own time to start doing some very limited part-time telehealth services to help adolescents who were struggling with some substance use disorders.
Well,
none of that was enough,
Yeah. I was just going to say, so, I mean, it seems like you were trying really hard to get help. Did anyone ever come through for you at all?
No.
Wow. And so when you look back and you look at how the outbreak happened, was there any sort of pivotal moment that led to that outbreak?
I don't think there was a single pivotal moment. I think it was a continuation of what was occurring. This wasn't an isolated event that suddenly occurred. The reason I titled the book Canary in the Coal Mine is because there are toxic environments that exist all across the country, and miners brought the canaries into the coal mines with them to warn them of toxic environments that might harm them. We have a very clear example in Austin, in Scott County, of what happens when we ignore toxic environments that are harming people. Mm-hmm. When I talked about, you know, protecting people from harm, I think that's what our obligation is to each other, is to protect people from harm. And if we know that there are social determinants for people's health, and when those vital community factors like safety and basic human needs and humane housing and meaningful work and transportation, food and shelter and safe environments, when we know those things are required in order for people to be healthy, wealthy, and have well-being, and we don't provide that to them, aren't we deciding whose lives are more important than others? Mm-hmm. In Indiana, we have Scott County versus Hamilton County. And if you're born in one of those two counties, your life expectancy can vary as much as 8 to 10 years.
Wow.
Just being born in a different county.
Yeah. And I think it gets to that whole conversation about equity and resources and access and you know, what happens when you don't have those.
Exactly. Because, you know, we want people to do well. I think most of us are very compassionate, caring people that want to see people do well. But we also want to see them take responsibility, you know, for their own lives. We don't want to do everything for them. But the fact remains that people can only choose from options that they have available to them. If somebody mm-hmm. like the man with the large tumor on his tongue doesn't have transportation, he doesn't have the choice to get somewhere to get help. If he doesn't have insurance, he doesn't have the choice to get somewhere to get help. If somebody grows up with, you know, a mom who uses drugs her whole life, or a dad who uses drugs their whole life, maybe they're abused. Maybe they never felt like they belong, and their parents or a loved one or a friend, you know, gives them a pill. They don't know what it is at 8, 10, 12, 14. They don't know what it is, but they know it makes them feel better. And then all of a sudden, you know, as a young adult, they find that they're hooked on prescription drugs. You know, they didn't choose that. They didn't choose mm-hmm. that. But what do we do to change that? You know, by providing people, you know, resources, safety, transportation, those basic human needs, when we meet those for people and then allow them to make those healthy choices, that's when their personal agency really kicks in. And, you know, somebody might be trying really, really hard in life. I keep this graphic on my computer. It's somebody pushing their health up a hill, and the hill has increasing gradients that are being propped up by lack of transportation, lack of insurance, lack of safety, lack of nutrition, and those sorts of things. If we can, you know, make that gradient shallower, level it out by providing those resources for people, then it's easier for them to push their health in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have about 2 minutes before the break. I'm curious to know, when the outbreak started to gain headlines, did you then start to hear from folks who were willing to help out?
Yeah, it went from nobody answering my call to everyone knocking on my door, literally. We had calls every few minutes, people showing up to the clinic, people calling my cell phone, wanting information, wanting to see how they could help. It was really overwhelming, and trying to figure out how to navigate all of that was difficult. And so I really turned to one of my mentors, really. Her name's Carolyn King, and she started a health coalition in Scott County. Knew a lot about coalition building, knew a lot about Scott County and the needs that Scott County had. And so with the help of Austin City and AIDS Healthcare Foundation, who came and reached out to me early to provide resources, we were able to hire her, and she was able to help us, you know, coordinate all that communication that was going on. Because I still had a job to do. You know, mm-hmm. I'm still busy, you know, delivering babies, working in the emergency department, seeing patients in the hospital and in the clinic, directing my staff. But having her was really, really meaningful.
Well, we'll continue our conversation after a quick break. We're talking with a doctor who spent years in Scott County, where an HIV outbreak in 2015 made national headlines, and who's recently written a book about his time there. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message without making a call by using our smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop, free and easy to use. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's VOXPOP. I'm Miriam Soeb. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're having a discussion with the sole physician who was working in Austin, Indiana, when the HIV outbreak happened there in 2015. He's written a book about his experience called Canary in the Coal Mine. If you have any questions or comments for our guest, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. With us again is Dr. William Cook, who runs a primary care clinic in Scott County, Indiana. Dr. Cook, before the break, we were talking just about how suddenly people were responding and paying attention to what was going on once the outbreak sort of made these headlines. How do you avoid feelings of perhaps resentment for saying, I've been warning you all these years and now you're coming in?
I'm just appreciative of them coming in. Again, when I went to the Amazon, I didn't have any expectation other than just trying to meet people where they were at, listening to stories and responding to needs when I came back. The fact that people were coming in now in 2015, I was appreciative of it. I wanted to make sure that we were able to take the resources that were coming in and connect them directly to people with those needs. I had three directives that I really just kind of repeated over and over and over to people as they came in. And I felt like our response needed to be directly patient-centered. So we needed to keep the patient in the middle of everything we did, not try to come with some outside solution that would come in and save the day, but really listen to people first and respond to their needs first. That it needed to be directly connected with local resources, not recreating the wheel. We did have some churches in the community trying to do some good work, my clinic. And I really felt like we needed to find those people that were already, you know, doing some feeding programs or trying to pick people up and take them to the doctor or where have you with transportation. Find those people that were already in the community working and empower them to be able to allow their passion that was already there before they had resources to have that much more impact. Because when the lights and camera went away, I knew that they were the people that were going to still be there. So patient-centered, directly connected to local resources, and that needed to be sustainable. I didn't want all this, you know, attention and media blitz and, you know, people from the government and agencies all over the country and world to come in, you know, for a year or whatever, and then leave and us be in the same position that we were in before. So patient-centered, directly connected to resources locally and sustainable. Mm-hmm. And people listened. People listened for the most part in trying to do that. And the thing that I'm probably the proudest of in my career is really making sure that the people that were suffering were heard. I really felt like they needed to be the leaders. We weren't coming in to help them so much as really seeing them as another person and helping our community and inviting them back into the community because they had been disconnected and marginalized for so long. Invite them back in, listen, and learn from them and allow them to lead us towards a brighter day, a better solution. And we've been successful by doing that.
Did the community's reaction to what happened change their perceptions at all, do you think, towards folks that were using drugs? Or I don't know if it brought people together?
It has and hasn't. There are still people that are, well, using the word that you mentioned earlier, resentful. And I understand that, you know, people who care about your community we all care about our community. And when we see certain segments of that community and we feel like they're harming our community, I can understand why there would be resentment that comes up. And it's easy to turn a finger and point blame. But I would, you know, remind people again that people only have the ability to choose from options they have available to them. And so we really need to look and see what options do they have to make healthy choices. And if they don't have options to make healthy choices, then it's our responsibility, not theirs, to provide them those opportunities. And then that's when their responsibility kicks in to be able to make those healthy choices. But for the most part, because we did get people's stories heard and people started to understand that when you live, you know, disconnected from the community, without sometimes running water, without a house, without transportation, you know, these sorts of things happen. And there was a lot of compassion, you know, given to people. Sometimes people were working right next to people who were using drugs and didn't know it. Maybe somebody in recovery working right next to somebody in recovery and they didn't know it. As these stories and the response progressed and more people in recovery started to come together and you're hearing those stories more, people started seeing their faces and understanding who they were and identifying, I worked right next to that person. He's all right. He's not the terrible person I thought all people who use drugs are.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps maybe also put more of a human face
exactly.
on it.
Yeah.
Well, did it change the misconceptions? Do you think that the community is more resilient and able to come together? Or is there still a lot of a fear and I guess folks not wanting to have to deal with this?
Again, it's a little bit of both. In the beginning, I felt like it was overwhelmingly fearful and resentful. We had a lot of, when this first happened and I announced that I was going to take care of people who use drugs and people who were living with HIV and hepatitis C, when I first announced that, we did get some angry phone calls. We had people, you know, threaten to leave my practice. We had some voicemails with death threats. I think they were, you know, acting out against their fears and their desire to see that their community was healthy. And right now, you know, we were in the middle of the international news as a place that was not healthy. Mm-hmm. And so I understood that anger and resentment. And I felt like if we got the message out that these were people, most people are compassionate. You know, this is the home of Ryan White. And we saw what happened with Ryan White. And I'm proud of Indiana for eventually, you know, finding him a place where he could go to school and showing him compassion. But it's also the state where he wasn't allowed to go to school. Mm-hmm. And so we have both segments. And, you know, I always see that as wrestling between fear and love. And I really believe that love will always overcome fear in the end. But fear can be a very powerful motivator to motivate people to, you know, push people away, to lash out. But I believe love can be an even more powerful motivator. Mm-hmm. When people hear the stories, understand the issues, understand what's going on in people's lives, see how people are living, that compassion can overcome the fear that they have.
Right. I think there's just a lot of fear of the unknown. And once you actually are faced with something, it's easier to understand it. We did a show a couple weeks ago about the recent decision by Scott County Commissioners to end the needle exchange program that was created there years ago. What was your reaction when you heard that news?
Disappointed. I felt like there was a lot of people who had used the syringe service program that came and very bravely, you know, stood up and gave their stories about how the syringe service program was the only place that they could identify where they had access to help. And as I've said, you know, several times, when people don't have access to healthy choices, how can we blame them, you know, for the behaviors that are going on in their life? But by giving them access to a healthy choice and allowing them to make that healthy choice, we can see very positive things occur in people's lives. And there was, you know, person after person that stood up and shared their testimony of how they found help at the Syringe Service Program, and now they're in recovery and they're helping other people. We have the largest recovery community organization in the state, one of the premier recovery community organizations in the country, I believe, directly because of the work of the Syringe Services Program. We're not only, when I say we, I support them and connect with them. They're called Thrive. And they're amazing people. They're people that were just a few years ago were injecting drugs or using drugs. And now they're peer recovery specialists helping people find recovery. And that organization wouldn't exist without access points like the Syringe Service Program. So I was very disappointed. I was disappointed that the rationale for closing it was that people needed to be responsible for their own health. And hearing people stand up and give their stories about how they were being responsible by going to the Syringe Service Program to get help and entering into recovery and then being responsible by turning around and helping other people, I had a hard time, you know, connecting those two dots, because here are people sharing how they were being responsible by using the Syringe Service Program, and they were closing it with the rationale that people needed to be responsible. So I had a real hard time with that.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of a misconception that if you have this program, it's going to encourage people to use. But I mean, are you fearful at all, worried that with the closure of something like this, it could cause cases to go up of HIV
absolutely.
And hepatitis?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but leading up to the outbreak, we saw abscesses. We saw people develop septic joints, lose parts of their limbs. We saw people develop heart infections because of using syringes that were not sterile. They were injecting bacteria into their bodies, and it was causing heart infections, lung infections, strokes in some people, kidney failure. Some people died from sepsis. You know, other people contracted hepatitis C, which is the leading cause of death in the world from an infectious disease standpoint. It's a devastating disease. If anybody's ever seen somebody die from hepatitis C, it's horrible. It's mm-hmm. a very agonizing, suffering death. Nobody needs to contract hepatitis C. And then HIV, it's a lifelong disease that has, you know, dire consequences to, you know, from a stigma standpoint, how they feel safe among other people, where they live and work. And then they're on a medication for the rest of their life. And none of that needs to happen. And providing syringes does not increase drug use, or anybody that's an insulin-dependent diabetic would be injecting drugs. And the fact is that among people who are insulin-dependent diabetics, their rate of injection drug use is no greater than the general population. So just having access to syringes does not increase drug use. That's not what causes drug use. What causes drug use is a toxic environment, that underlying toxic stress, adverse childhood experiences, sometimes genetics that unlocks this thing inside of people. And one thing leads to another, and people don't want to use drugs. Most people hate themselves for using drugs, and it just builds on top of all that toxic stress and environment that they've experienced most of their life. Now they hate themselves because they're doing this thing that they hate, but they don't know mm-hmm. how to stop. Mm-hmm. They just need help. And providing access to help, I don't know how that could be anything other than compassionate.
Right. And it sounds like, I mean, some of the issues are deeper than just maybe the drug use is a surface level issue, and there's something deeper that needs to be done in the community. And
yes,
I wonder what that would be. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than people might realize.
Dr. Jerome Adams was our health commissioner and went on to become the Surgeon General under Trump. While he was Surgeon General, he issued a report called Community Health and Economic Prosperity. And in that report, they identified decades of research that confirms that there are several vital community factors that leads to health, prosperity, and well-being. And without those, people suffer. People die early. People develop diseases. And the fact is, we've ignored that for decades. And what has resulted is we've went from leading the world in life expectancy to being last in the developed world for life expectancy. That should be a national crisis. None of us should be willing to accept that we are last in the developed world for life expectancy. If it was any other factor, we would be doing everything we can to change that. If our military was last, think of what we'd be doing and investing to make it first again. If our economy was last, we would be moving mountains. Mm-hmm. Our health is last in the developed world. What are we doing about it? We're just ignoring it. We know that the reason for this decline in our health and a decline in our life expectancy is related to these vital community factors, and they include humane housing, transportation, meaningful work, a sense of belonging, civic muscle, meaning that you feel like your opinion matters and you are able to make change in your community, and safe outdoor spaces that aren't toxic to people. If we can all come to some sort of agreement that at the very minimum, everyone deserves those things in order to be healthy, we wouldn't have a 10-year life expectancy difference between counties in the same state.
And it sounds also like somehow that community needs to be revitalized, like the idea of community in general. I feel like we've kind of lost that over the decades. You know, everybody's kind of isolated on their own. But I don't know. That's just my thoughts.
Yeah, I think we value rugged individualism, and that's fantastic. But I'm going to go back to something I've said several times, that people can only make choices from options that they have available to them. If you're born in a pocket of poverty and toxic stress with no transportation, my mom grew up, she grew up basically squatting on the Ohio River. She remembers, grabbing a handful of her belongings and scurrying to a shelter in the middle of the night because they got found out that they were living there and they had to move. Her dad, drank alcohol, or her mom used benzos. They both ran around on each other. He abused all of them. She grew up with all of that, and there was no way out. There was no way out, but people showed up to, give her access to opportunities and resources that she would have never been able to discover on her own. And that's what people need. People need to have people in these situations need for people to show up at the right time to mm-hmm. help them with transportation, with housing, with food, with shelter, with safety. And unless those needs are met, people don't do well.
Right. And I think it's up to all of us to sort of pitch in and take on some of those responsibilities. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Dr. William Cook runs a primary care clinic in Scott County, Indiana. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.